In the end, I decided she would be an ideal person to place close to the teacher Jesus. So I brought her to Jerusalem and instructed her in what I wished her to do. She still worked in her chosen profession, but with a limited number of clients, most of whom were known to me. I must say now that this was very difficult for me, personally, as I had become most attached to the girl, who was pleasing in all possible ways. However, it was essential for me to collect information concerning Jesus, so I arranged Naomi's household accordingly. Petros was an educated young man who worked on the fringes of the military presence in Judea, and who I knew thirsted after advancement, even though he was unable to speak, struck dumb when a ship's mast fell on him during a terrible storm that overtook him as he sailed with his fisherman father, who died in the same storm. It was already well known that he ministered to those of his own sex, and I made him an attractive and generous offer. He would be brought to live with Naomi, and would be available for the daily work and for the use of any clients who preferred his own Greek offering. Most important, Petros was to spend a minimum of 1 hour a day, during which Naomi would recount to him all things that had happened during her past day. These things would be set down, in detail, in a journal, and Petros was charged with keeping this and holding the results close. This is the journal to be found, written in Greek, on the 4 scrolls that accompany this letter. I also provided Naomi with a girl to act both as a body servant and as a replacement in the bedchamber, if a client so desired. This was a Nubian, some 12 or 13 years of age, the daughter of the woman Abzi, who was one of the female slaves acting as servants to senior members of the legion. The girl, Azeb, or Sheba, as she was sometimes known, became a great help to Naomi, even though she tended to talk out of turn and to be sullen. Naomi recounts that she was forced to punish Azeb often because of the girl's unbridled tongue. I commend to you what Petros set down in these scrolls, as it was told to him by Naomi, for she, being a woman of exceptional intelligence, has been scrupulous in recounting both her actions and feelings. In many ways the plan I had conceived went astray, yet all was not lost by it. Naomi grew enamoured of the teachings of this Jesus, and became a true believer of what he communicated to all his disciples. Indeed, she came to accept him as the Messiah, as the Jewish faith had foretold. In this there is a great and deep story of both human and divine dimensions. There is much to learn and on which to ponder, just as there are many mysteries that are difficult for us to understand. I write this in the early morning of the second day of the week. I sit on a hillside a good way from Jerusalem, and my own mind is reeling from the events that surround Jesus and what has happened in the past days, in particular the news that reached us yesterday. At the end of last week, the man Jesus was sentenced to death by my friend Pilate. At the last minute, I was put in charge of the execution detail. So we took Jesus and crucified him at the usual place just outside the city. It was a difficult, unpleasant business. And because of the Jewish religious holy festival Passover, it was necessary to make sure the condemned man was dead and buried by nightfall. I tried to be as much help as I could in the plan that had been devised and passed on to me through Naomi. This plan was to save Jesus from death by taking him down early from the cross. I do not know what finally happened, except that Naomi herself was forced to run and hide, for there were men and women who wanted to see her dead. Now Naomi's gone, her friends are dead, and Jesus is reported to have risen from the dead. How these things can be, I do not know, but there is much to read in the last words of Naomi, as she dictated to Petros. I must go, as I fear for my life also. There followed a note saying that the original document had been signed by Romilius. Charlie returned the papers to Palfrey, pushing them away as though he could not wait to get rid of them, giving the impression that a bad smell was hovering just below his upper lip. You really think this is genuine, Kit? Convinced of it? Charlie made a shrugging gesture, big and over the top. So if this is for real, why hasn't the church started to scream it from the rooftops then? Why hasn't His Holiness the Pope had something to say? Urbi et Orbi, or whatever he does. Come to that, why hasn't the Archbishop of Canterbury had a word to say about it? Cause, if it's genuine, Kit, then it's proof positive that Christianity is the one true faith and Jesus is the main man. This, I guess, would be brilliant news for the church. More than brilliant, Chuck. Right. And don't call me Chuck, Kit. He remembered now how well Kit had known him in their past life, and was aware of his own constant questioning of truth, both fact and rumour. The former head of interrogation, the leathery Gus Keane, had said of Gauntlet that he'd popped out of the womb and immediately done a hostile Q&A, indicating that he didn't believe his mother was his mother, or his father was his father. Born with it, Gus had said. Born with suspicion. Doesn't believe the sky's up and the earth is round, unless you can bring in proofs. So why isn't the Christian Church, in its many forms, screaming this from the rooftops, Kit? Palfrey sighed, after the manner of one who was unaccustomed to dealing with people of a low IQ. His Holiness, His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury, and even the Archimandrite of the Donskoy Monastery, have said nothing because, as you well know, Chuck, part of the delight of our calling is our ability to keep secrets. They haven't said anything because they know nothing. The monks of the Order of St. Jerome also know how to keep their lips buttoned. QED. Quite easily done, as my waggish old chemistry teacher used to quip. Okay, Kit. How long have we known one another? Uncharacteristically, Palfrey scratched his head. 30, 33, 5 years, give or take a couple. And in that time, have you ever had cause to doubt me? And have I ever had cause to doubt you? The answer to that is yes, with the rest of the country. Yes. Whatever you say now, Kit, you're still a proven traitor, a gold-plated liar, and a dissembler. And no, I'm not going to telephone anyone. You're saying you don't believe me? Let's say you're right. I like a challenge, and this is bloody challenging. But I find it hard to believe. Palfrey put on his face best suited to one who has been greatly wronged. What precisely don't you believe? All of it. I have to be persuaded. It's, well, what can you call it? Glib. Would the holy monks help you? How the hell do I know, Kit? I never knew you were religious before. I never had the slightest inkling. Never suspected that you had a single religious bone in your brain, actually, Kit. I didn't. So I didn't until this. I was skeptical until this. I couldn't conceive the mystery of Christ until this. Palfrey was becoming more and more aggressive, serious, deadly serious. But this did the trick. Yes. With a little help from your friendly monks, right? A tiny pause. The monks helped me understand certain things. Chuck, read it, please. Please read your way through it. It's a story that'll amaze you. I found the whole thing unsettling. Didn't know what to believe. There are things in those scrolls that are a million light years from what we think of as Christianity. Naomi describes everything about her life. Then, as she falls under the influence of Jesus' teaching, she goes through a kind of rehabilitation. I also found it too easy, Charlie. I couldn't somehow take in the history. And I realized that, for years, I'd been thinking of the Jesus story as a kind of fairy tale. And it's not. It's a true piece of history. A lot of us had some pretty half-baked teaching about Christ and the Christian Church. And I think that's why people have relegated it to a myth. It's not a myth, Chuck. It all happened. And this helps prove it. Kid, I just find it... No, Chuck, please. Palfrey's voice rose, anger flicking through his tone. You've got married, right? Yes, but where is she? Who? Your wife. The woman you were with last night, the one with the great eyes and the smashing tits. Hey, Kit, you want a diverticulated septum. You're going the right way to get one, talking about my wife like that. I was paying you both a compliment. Where is she? At work. She's a cop, the yard. She's with OS-13, anti-terrorist. She gets back when? Maybe a couple of days, maybe weeks. Hard to tell. You let her roam around out there for a couple of days? Palfrey sounded genuinely shocked. Charlie grinned. Kit, things have changed over the years. Me? I'm a 90s man now. To marry her, I had to give up being a male chauvinist porker. Okay? That means you'd be free to come up to ring my rookie? Only if I say so, Kit. With you, I can still be a terrible chauvinist pain in the ass. And monks aren't my scene. Which, in a way, was why, when Bex called him from Heathrow en route to Dublin, Charlie Gauntlet, husband elite, told her that he might be going to Scotland. He did not tell her that once more he thought he had glimpsed an old comrade. Looking from his window on that London morning, he could have sworn that he saw Patsy Wright, just as he thought he'd seen him on the previous evening. This time he was more distant, loitering on the edge of a far pavement. It was an eon since he'd seen Patsy, and now, twice in the same number of days. It puzzled Charlie and nagged quietly in the back of his mind. He shielded his eyes and peered toward the figure. The man standing across the street turned, and Charlie saw clearly that it was not Patsy after all. He didn't know it couldn't possibly be Patsy, because Patsy was minding Bex in Dublin.